Interesting talk. So we're both scientists, and I always find it very interesting to know why people are doing what they're doing. And so you're working on carbon fixation and feeding the world, which is one of the biggest challenges that we have as a species. And so why did you get interested into this topic? Is it because you were interested in biological organisms and then you saw this process of carbon fixation that you found was interesting? Or were you driven more by a solution, like a social problem that you were trying to solve, and then you found a way to maybe help into that direction?
Yeah. So I was always applicative in mind. So I always was oriented to try to solve problem. So there is, you know, this inherent tension in science between those that focus on basic research and said that the applicative part is, you know, secondary and it's not the real interesting part, and those that see the applicative part as, you know, as leading the way and the basic research actually follows that. So I was always in the second camp, and I don't think that there is right or wrong here, of course, but for me, it was always trying to solve problem. And I remember in my case from high school that my biology teacher accused me that I'm not a real thinker like a scientist, but more like an engineer. And it's true, I'm thinking like an engineer, but it doesn't mean that I'm not doing science. So and what about you in this regard? So do you see yourself more as a scientist or engineer?
I went to engineering school, so yeah, I was formatted to think about solving problems, which I found was interesting, and I always being interested in health problems. I remember that when I was a kid, both of my parents got really sick. They got like a nasty infection, like a bacterial infection, and like from one day to the other, both of my parents were in the hospital, like, and that was like a real shock to me, and so I got interested in diseases and this kind of stuff and trying to solve these diseases. So I saw that as a problem.
So it's a little bit not fair, isn't it? Because it's two engineers sits there, no one here to represent the basic science.
Yes, but like I mean, the work where we're doing wouldn't be possible without the basic science. And I think it's a little bit lying to ourselves to say that. That they're not like engineers and we're not the fundamental scientists, because whatever we're doing, we're learning about how the plant works or the bacteria works. So it's like a constant feedback between those.
I think that you see it probably as well, but when we scientists, we live by funding. Basically, we cannot do anything by not getting money from the public. That's, you know, from money from you, basically. And there are some funding agencies that want to see almost only applicative stuff. The European Commission, if the European Commission is funding something, it's always needs to have some, you know, a very clear output how we're going to change humanity. While other funding agencies are focusing only on basic science. So, you know, all of us are doing both of them, you know, even from the point of view of getting money, you need to be very smart if you put yourself as an engineer or put yourself as a basic research kind of scientist.
Yeah. So in terms of feeding the world, we're talking about seeds, we're talking about plants, about evolving plants in agriculture. Do you think actually agriculture is going to solve the problem of feeding people?
Yeah. Or? So, you know, in a sense, this is the $1 million question. So we definitely need to have better agriculture, that's for sure. And or at least that's what I'm trying to propose. But I think that if we want to be a little bit crazy and think about, you know, the future, we could think about other ways in which we could feed ever-growing population, not just here on Earth, but maybe also when we are going to adventure out of Earth. And this could be actually, and it will sound crazy to some of you, eating microbes. So some microbes are actually very nutritious. Yeast, for example, people eat yeast today, and it has all the necessary building block in food. And another thing that we are trying to do in my lab is actually to enable microbes to grow on electricity and CO2 as the only energy and carbon source. So basically, we can convert wind and CO2 into food, and then, you know, we can feed the world in other ways but agriculture. So you can imagine that if we are going to Mars in 50 years, instead of relying on the contaminated soil there, we can actually try to produce our food from microbes.
From scratch, from microbes.
Yeah. So hopefully we will not be married to plants forever.
So what you're saying is basically that if we want to survive as a species, we will have to like really change our whole alimentary culture or of food production.
I think that's true also today. Like if you look,
like we have no choice. Like we need to eat GMOs or yeah, people are scared, right?
This is the tricky point, of course, the GMO. This is, you know, talking about GMO is also being a little bit provocative, and you know, people probably in the audience has completely different views about it. From my perspective, as someone who is actually in the field, I think that some of the fear related to GMO are founded, but many others are, I would even say, related to a politics of fear. That, you know, if you see how the world is going on in the last decade or so, you just try to make people feel of this or that. So many of the issues that make people, you know, take a step back because of GMO related to a bit of ignorance about the field. Because from the perspective of what we actually thought that could be problematic, we currently have no scientific evidence for this problem actually occurring.
Yeah, so it is true that the general public is not necessarily educated on the inner workings of the GMO and whether it affects them or not, but I think that their fear, it's founded in the sense not of the molecular level, but on how this technology of the GMO is being used and all the political and social problems that it has in hand. So indeed, the technology can have a lot of benefits, and I agree with that, but it's the way it's been used right now by certain corporations that is really provoking this not necessarily fear, but rejection of this technology. And so in that sense, I think we also need to be a little bit critical in, okay, whenever we develop a technology, how are we actually going to implement it and whether it's going to damage or not different levels of society. And not only on the molecular level, of whether when I eat a GMO corn, I'm gonna get sick, which I don't, there's no, still, for now, no scientific evidence for that. But, well, people care that it might affect the farmer or it might affect...
So here I fully agree. I think that the major problem we have currently with the GMO that it is controlled by very big companies that abuse their power in many cases. But this is a general problem that we have current in the Western society of, you know, big companies that controls big sectors. I think that it's important, though, to distinguish between the technology itself and those that control the technology. And I would agree that we have a lot to go to make this technology something that is available to everyone and not controlled by a big company that creates social disturbances. But this is not to say the technology itself is bad, just the way that it's come.
Exactly. It's the way we use it, yeah.
Yeah.
And... well, I now want to move to this analogy that you were using about biological systems as chaotic systems. It's funny because you say that they're very sensitive to changes, like noise gets expanded. I actually believe they're quite robust. I actually believe that it's different from my experience with biological organisms. Whenever we try to change them, they will come back to their initial form, or they will basically escape our control. And in the case of your plant, so imagine that you put your plant outside in nature. I think there is a reason why their plants are not that efficient in carbon fixation. Do you think that at some point, the plant will lose that ability? I think they're quite robust.
Okay, so you're right that living organism can deal with a lot of different conditions and survive and actually not just survive, actually grow and multiply in many different conditions. I would claim that for changes that the organism was evolved to cope with, it will be very robust. So a plant could survive a long drought conditions, as we will hear later. A plant could survive different level of fertilization, of different level of light, and so on and so forth, because the plant was evolved to actually survive it. But if you are go inside and tinker with its small genes, with how it works from the inside, this kind of abuses the plant was never actually evolved to withstand. And this is where the chaotic system comes into play.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I engineer a system, and then since basically I'm provoking something to happen, the bacteria that I engineer lose their ability after a few generations.
But I would call it chaotic response also. Because basically it's exactly the same point. You engineer a system. You think that you know what's going to happen according to your knowledge of the system, but eventually the system behaves how it wants to behave, getting rid of the genes that you put inside or changing its metabolism, its overall genetics in a way that you could not predict. So basically this is exactly this kind of a chaotic behavior that, you know, you cannot just, you know, design stuff and it will work like an electrical engineer designing a chip, and this chip is you know, just functioning by itself.
Yeah. So going back to your plants, so if they are able to do carbon fixation more efficiently, what does it actually mean? Like, is the plant going to be bigger, or is it going to be, like, I have a hard time.
That's a great question. The real answer is don't know.
Okay.
So it really depends on the plants.
Yeah.
So there were very interesting experiment done with plants that you put under elevated CO2. For example, you put them under CO2 level, which are triple the amount of we currently have. And this, of course, makes carbon fixation much faster. Okay. Some of the plants grew very fast, but then stop at the same amount of biomass. Some of them grew in the same rate, but the amount of harvested biomass, the amount of fruit of the grain was much higher. And some of them did not change at all. So basically, it's really dependent on the plants. And it's, again, saying about chaotic system, every plant, every system, every context behave a little bit differently. So we don't know yet what increased carbon fixation rate will actually translate in the field. It could be that for rice, for example, it will increase the grain. It could be that for wheat, it will not do anything. So this is simply something that we need to test and see.
We will have to live with the contingency of
biology.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.